Welcome to Bina, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of Bina, our guests are Jim McCloskey, founder of Centurion Ministries, and veteran broadcast news and television producer Philip Lehrman. Together, they're the co-authors of the book When Truth Is All You Have, a memoir of faith, justice, and freedom for the wrongly convicted. They're joined in conversation by Rabbi Brian Glusman, Director of Outreach and Engagement at the Marcus JCC in Atlanta. And now welcome Jim McCloskey, Philip Lehrman, and Rabbi Brian Glusman.
Good evening. I am Brian Glusman, the rabbi of the Marcus Jewish Community Center of Atlanta. On behalf of the Marcus JCC and the National JCC Literary Consortium, I am pleased to welcome you to this very special Bookfest in Your Living Room event, featuring the founder of Centurion Ministries, Jim McCloskey, and author and former national editor of USA Today, Phil Lehrman. The two will be discussing their very important and deeply moving book, When Truth Is All You Have, a memoir of faith, justice, and freedom for the wrongly convicted. And now a little bit about our evening's guests. Jim McCloskey is the founder of Centurion Ministries, the first group in America devoted to overturning wrongful convictions. His story was the basis of John Grisham's book, The Guardians. He has a Master's of Divinity from Princeton Theological Seminary. Today, McCloskey is retired from active oversight of Centurion, though he continues to serve on the board and pursue cases. Philip Lehrman has been the national editor of USA Today, co-producer of America's Most Wanted, and executive producer of PBS's Made in Spain. He is the author of Datitude and co-author of numerous nonfiction books. Please welcome them both to our virtual stage this evening.
There you are. Hey, Jim.
Hey, Phil.
Great to see you.
Yeah.
How you doing?
I'm hanging in there. Hanging in there.
Let's jump right into it. You know, when I talk to people about the book, they always want to know, how did Jim get started on this? And it's a remarkable story that you're a 37-year-old seminary student, which how that happened, we'll have to talk about in a minute. But you were doing your seminary work in prison, and you've changed so many people's lives over the years. But you were in prison, and you were doing your seminary work, and you met the guy who changed your life. So can you tell us that story?
Yeah, well, I was, as you said, a 37-year-old seminary student. Seeking a Master Divinity degree, thinking I was going to become ordained as a church pastor. I did my field work at Trenton State Prison as a student chaplain. And I was assigned two cell blocks in the maximum security unit, which supposedly housed the most violent of New Jersey's prisoners. And one of the 40 men who I would visit, I would just walk down the cell block, go cell to cell. One of the 40 men I became their friends or ministered to, if you will, and that was just to be their friends, was Jorge de los Santos, who was in a 6-year of a life sentence for a Newark murder that he consistently and persistently claimed he didn't do. So over a several month period of time, without going into a lot of detail, I came to believe that I read his transcripts and asked him a ton of questions, and I came to believe that he was an innocent man. And then he challenged me. He said, well, you've asked me a million questions, and I have one question for you. And I said, what's that, Jorge? He said, do you believe I'm innocent? And I said, yes, I do believe you're innocent. He says, well, what are you going to do about it? I said, what do you mean, what am I going to do about it? I don't have any experience in the criminal justice system. I've never been in a courtroom. I'm not a lawyer. He said, I've been on my knees for 6 years praying for somebody, for God to send somebody to save me and get me out of this hellhole. And whether you know it or whether you believe it or not, you're that man. You just can't go back to your seminary believing I'm innocent and pray for my release that somebody else will come to my rescue. And he really struck me with that declaration and that challenge. And I went back to my nice, secure little seminary. And believe it or not, I opened the scriptures to Isaiah, the prophet, in chapter 59. And Isaiah talked about how they don't go to, this is almost 3,000 years ago, 2,700 years ago. Isaiah talked about in that passage, which I just happened to open up, that they do not go to law honestly. Justice is turned back. Justice is far from us. Truth has fallen from the public squares. And the Lord wondered that there was no one to intervene. I looked at that word, intervene, and I thought, maybe this is God's sign for me to intervene and help Chiefy, which was his nickname. So I decided to take a year off from school and work full time to try and move the ball towards freeing and exonerating him.
And so you did, and you took that year off and worked for that year. And you had no background in this. You had no history of any kind of work like this. But you tracked down the people who lied on the stand. You figured out that the DA not only was aware of it, was complicit in the lying that went on. And there was a moment in court when you realized that you had this and you found the information and you freed Chiefy de los Santos and he walked out of that prison. What must that day have been like for you?
Well, you know, first of all, I was fortunate, very lucky, in my search for an attorney, to find a great attorney by the name of Paul Castellero, who at that time, almost 40 years ago, was a solo practitioner and a criminal defense attorney. Currently, Paul is now a full-time legal director of Centurion. Paul and I worked very carefully and closely together. I found both the lying eyewitnesses. One of them, the main witness, Richard De La Santa, told me that he did lie, and he laid out the story why he lied at the instance of the Essex County Prosecutor's Office in Newark.
But they knew he was lying. They coerced him into lying.
Well, yes, they did. And he was a known informant. And at Chiefy's trial, he denied under direct examination by the prosecutor that he was an informant. So Paul and I were able to develop an extensive documentation on his informant activities prior to Chiefy's trial, including in the prosecutor's own handwriting in the prosecutor's trial file was the notation, Richard De La Santa in habit of giving testimony. So that proved right then and there that not only did De La Santa fabricate this jailhouse confession kind of testimony, but the trial prosecutor knew that it was a fabrication and knew that he lied about not being an informant. And with that, the federal district judge, once we demonstrated that through an evidentiary hearing, the federal district judge vacated the conviction and set Mr. De Los Santos free after 8 years of wrongful imprisonment.
Well, let me follow up on that, because I remember you talking about when you first started this, you were thinking, well, the DA must not know that this guy was lying, or the police must not know that they have the wrong man, because nobody would want to send an innocent man to prison. But over the years, you found again and again and again that not only were the police complicit, that the DA would fabricate evidence, they would create false jailhouse confessions. This is a systemic problem. This was not a chance problem. And that's what you started to learn as you went along, isn't it?
Well, yeah, but yes, I did. Absolutely. It is systemic. We have been fortunate enough to free 64 innocent people, including three women all across the country who were completely innocent and serving life or death for the crimes of others. And in at least two-thirds of those cases, there was some form of prosecutorial misconduct in that they suborned perjury or falsified evidence or hid evidence from the defense. And this is a problem that really plagues America's criminal justice system, without a doubt. But let me say this also. When I started this work, when I first met Chiefy De Los Santos and even was conversing with him about whether he did this or not, at that time, I never served on a jury. I never had any experience with a criminal justice system. And I believe that police and prosecutors would never bring to the bar of justice an innocent person, let alone evidence of guilt that wasn't credible. I just couldn't believe that they would do that. And I have discovered since then that it's done far more often than we care to think.
So when people think about, you know, the innocence projects and the cause of innocence, they think, oh, well, DNA has started freeing people and that's how it's done. But this, you started this, I want to point out to everybody, 10 years before, 8 years before anybody had ever been freed by DNA. And you mostly did non-DNA cases. You didn't have any money. You were just driving down the roads, finding the people who lied and getting them to admit the truth. How did that happen?
Well, you know, when Paul and I freed Mr. De Los Santos in July of 1983, by that time, a lot of things came together. I had returned to the seminary while continuing to work for him, obtained my Master of Divinity degree, and had met three other New Jersey lifers in whose innocence I had come to believe during the last 2.5 years that I was working for De Los Santos. So now I was faced with a life-altering decision, and that was this. Do I go on and become an ordained church pastor, Presbyterian church pastor, as I intended to do when I came to the seminary, or is God calling me in a different direction, namely maybe to set up a nonprofit organization dedicated to identify and free innocent people in prison and start that enterprise with these three men who I had met and come to believe as well. I was broke at that time. I didn't have any money. I was living in a rent-free room in a home owned by a delightful octogenarian in Princeton. But my parents gave me some extraordinary money. They gave each of us three children a $10,000 tax-free gift. I looked at that as literally as manna from heaven and as capital to start up this new organization to work to free innocent people from prison, in the most serious cases, those who were serving either life or death. So I started the organization. I named it Centurion, after the centurion at the foot of the cross, who looked up at the crucified Christ and said, certainly this man was innocent. So it all began there in the fall of 1983.
So I'm going to take you back to the first time I met you, just about 4 years ago tonight. Because right after that email, you and I got together at we met in neutral turf on an office in Baltimore. Right. And I was just going there to, you know, see you and I could chat and see if this was something we wanted to do together. And you were so extraordinarily honest and open with me about how you came to this work. And I'd like to ask you to share a little bit of that now. I mean, you were a successful businessman. You were making a good living. You were going to church on Saturday. But you told me you were also living a secret life. And I was so struck by the fact that you were so open and honest about it and how that life led you here. So I'm going to put you on the spot and ask you to tell folks a little bit about
that. Well, yeah, I was, during the 1970s, I came to this revelation that I am to leave the business world and go into the ministry in early 1979. But throughout the 1970s, I had a great job. I was working for a large management consulting company headquartered in Philadelphia, and my job was to build its business with Japanese companies in the U.S. and set us up in Tokyo, because I had been with another consulting company in Tokyo for 5 years. So I had a bit of knowledge about the Japanese way of doing business. So I would commute from Philadelphia to New York several days a week. During that time, I was behaving in a reckless, promiscuous manner. I would go over to Times Square and pick up women of the night and spend an evening with them or an hour or two with them. Nobody knew I was doing this. At the same time, I was dating a married woman, although she was in the middle, she was separated from her husband. So let's say I was leading a life that was not at all pleasing to God. And at the same time, as you mentioned, I would come on the weekends. That's what I was doing during the week. On the weekends, I would mostly spend Saturday night at home reading scripture. I had felt that my life was missing something, which was the spiritual element. I wanted to regain my faith of my boyhood back in Sunday school. And so I started reading scripture. and it became very important to me was my meat and drink. So I was leading this double, triple life, going to church every Sunday morning, being inspired and moved by Dick Streeter's preaching, most of which the message was to wash the other's feet, to serve others, to do good for them and not yourself. And so I'm wrestling with this over several years. Two things were percolating within me. One was that I felt my life was hollow, selfish, self-centered, and left a lot to be desired. I lost my moral way. My moral compass had gone off the track. At the same time, I'm regaining a spiritual consciousness and depth, I thought, and I'm starting to. I looked at my minister. He was touching the lives of hundreds of people, the hearts and souls of those people. I was touching nobody's life except myself and my corporation. So I eventually, over time, I felt the call to leave the business world, leave that life of that I was leading, and declare who I was. I was a man. I wanted to be a man of God and to serve others in that capacity. So consulting only with Dick Streeter, I consulted with nobody else. My family, my friends had no idea what I was about ready to do, and in fact did, namely, leave the business world and go up to Princeton Theological Seminary, thinking I was going to become, as Dick Streeter was, an ordained Presbyterian church pastor.
And then fate and Chiefy de los Santos intervened as well to move you in that direction. So many people have benefited from your work. There are so many interesting cases I learned about working on this with you. I'm just going to ask you about one of them, because there you were working on these cases, these Jersey cases, and all of a sudden you found yourself dealing with a case of somebody on death row in, of all places, Texas. And the clock is ticking. When you got to the Clarence Bradley story, he was how many days, how far away was he from execution?
Well, when I started the case, when I actually hit the field and began the reinvestigation, he was 3 weeks away from execution in Texas. This was in March of 1987.
What happened? Very briefly, Clarence Bradley was a janitor. They said he had raped and killed a high school student at the high school where he worked. He was framed by the sheriff. They set him up. He's a black man. They decided he was the one they were going to frame. You got on the scene, and your clock is ticking, and you had to find somebody to get him out of prison. How did you do that? How did you get him out?
Well, I was fortunate enough to be accepted. Me being from New Jersey, I just don't fly down to Texas and start working for the person, because he had a good legal team already in place, although they had exhausted all avenues to free him. And they didn't think there was any other place to go, that he, in fact, was going to die by execution. And so I suggested, well, look, I read all the transcripts and the post-conviction hearings and all that. One of the three witnesses against him, John Henry Sessom, he might be the one. He might just he started to unravel his trial testimony. Let's go talk to John and see if maybe he will be willing to tell the truth of the matter, if in fact he lied. So I did go. I found John Henry Sessom, and with another investigator who had been working on the case for years prior to that, we talked to John. And as it turned out, John was having nightmares about this, because he stood by and did nothing to assist her when she was yelling for help, as two other janitors, the two white janitors, grabbed her and took her up to the restroom and sexually assaulted her and killed her. When they started to accost her, John Henry ran downstairs. And now, hearing her screams for help all the time, not only did he do that, but he helped put an innocent man on death row who was about ready to get executed.
You're listening to Jim McCloskey and Philip Lehrman, co-authors of the book When Truth Is All You Have, a memoir of faith, justice, and freedom for the wrongly convicted. They're joined in conversation by Rabbi Brian Glusman on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
When you met John Henry Sessoms, at first he said he was going to work with you, but things didn't go in a straight line.
Oh, it was a roller coaster ride. The clock was ticking. We had 3 weeks from the day we first met with John to the date of execution,
March 3rd. 3 weeks.
We had 3 weeks. So it was a roller coaster ride. I mean, John was, you know, he wanted to tell the truth. He did tell us the truth, but then he would get scared because he was always afraid of two people, the real killers who still lived in that area and the Texas Ranger who coerced him into falsely false incriminating evidence against Clarence. So he was, and he just, you know, it's tough to tell the world that you did not come to the victim's assistance and help possibly save her life. And on top of that, you put an innocent man in prison or helped to do so. Anyway, we helped John overcome those fears, but it was an up and down endeavor because he agreed to come and he told us the whole story. He agreed to come down to Houston. I would pick him up and take him down to the lawyer's office and take a statement from him, but he never showed. So when we went back to see him, John, what's the matter? He said, well, come on in the house. He lived in a shack, and we could tell something was bothering him. And then the next thing we know, he goes in the kitchen and comes out with a butcher knife and tells us to get the hell out. Well, that was 8 days before the execution. We thought we lost John. He's not going to do what he knows he should do and has promised us he was going to do. But we went to a next door neighbor of his who was knew exactly what we were doing. And she said, I will talk with John. The next day, St. Paddy's Day, 1987, we'll never forget it. The lawyers and I went back up to John's place. He was there and he agreed to give a videotaped statement. And with that, we were able to get a stay of execution 6 days before the date of execution. The courts granted him a stay. By that time, I had gotten 60 minutes into the case. They came down and they interviewed John. John went on national TV and told the audience what he had done or what he had not done, and what the real story was, who the killers were, what he had observed. He was an eyewitness to this crime. And with that, the whole case came apart. And over time, we were able to free and exonerate Clarence Brantley.
That's an amazing, amazing story. And, you know, we're here at the JCC, and in the Jewish faith, justice is such a watchword of what we are called to do. And in this moment in time, there's such a Black Lives Matter aspect to the justice that you have worked so hard for over the years. Most of your clients are African-American. Most wrongly convicted are African-American. Isn't that the case?
Yeah, that is the case. And first of all, there's no question, you know, African-Americans account for maybe 12 or 13% of our population here in the U.S. And there have been over 2,600 exonerations that have been documented since 1989, and 50% of them are African-American. Of the 64 people we freed, 40 are Black folks. But the reason for that is why they bear the brunt of wrongful convictions, which is I think unquestionable, is because there is whether you call it implicit or explicit or a combination of both, there is systemic racism, I believe, embedded within our law enforcement agencies, within the police across the country, which enables them or justifies them to really make false accusations against people of color far more often than it happens to whites or even Latinos. So it's a very It's a very sad, I mean, you look at the 20 some or so folks who have been fatally shot by police without any real provocation that have made the public airways has become very public accounts of such killings. In every single case, every one, New York, Philadelphia, Baltimore, Atlanta, Florida, Cincinnati, Chicago, you know, St. Louis, Cleveland, everywhere, Tucson. Why is it? Why is it that every person who's been fatally shot by the police while basically minding their own business were persons of color, and that the shooting police officer was white? I think that's far more than just coincidence.
And it's far more than coincidence, as you said, that so many of the wrongly convicted are Black. And it, in this time of COVID, when prisons are such a hotbed of COVID, when there is no such thing as social distancing when you're in prison, your work has really become a matter of life and death. People who support your work, and I hope everybody does support your work, people who support your work are literally saving lives, and Black lives much more often at risk in times of COVID. Isn't that the case?
Well, yeah, it is. And we're, you know, we are working for one man. His name is Ben Spencer. He's been in prison now for 33 years. He was convicted of a murder in Dallas, Texas, back in 1987. And even though in 2008, a Dallas County judge declared him to be an actually innocent man, he still languishes in prison.
Because you talk to him every weekend.
He calls me every Saturday morning, and we bring him up on new developments in his case. And there are new developments. But one of the reasons I mentioned him is because he lives in an open dormitory, 110 men, and their beds are 3 feet apart. They have no social distancing. They share 8 different toilets or urinals or shower heads. They are restricted in their movements. And it's the perfect environment for the COVID-19 to spread, to hit and spread. And it's a problem down there. And I worry every day about Ben. And is he going to get that? His mother and sister got it in their homes. His sister lives in works in a nursing home, and she got it and then brought it home, and his mother got it. But fortunately, they have recovered from it. So he worries not only about himself, but about his family. And there he is, stuck in prison for something he didn't do and has been declared innocent by a county judge.
Well, listen, you know, when you and I get going, we could go on a long time. We're going to bring, going to ask Rabbi Brian to come back in a minute. I just want to ask you one last question. You know, for a Jewish kid from the Bronx, I learned a lot about the saints from you. You don't know this, but one of the things you told me that we put in the book, a quote from St. Paul, I put up on a wall here: the suffering produces endurance, endurance produces character, and character produces hope. And in these difficult times, I think about that every day. I have that right here, so I remember it every day, that in these difficult times, when everybody is in their own way feeling isolated, you, more than anybody who has not lived through it, know what these people lived through. Can you offer some words of inspiration from what you've done and what you've learned about how people live through the unsufferable, and somehow that suffering produces endurance, and how we can learn from them how to keep hope alive?
Well, one answer to that question relates directly to the title of our book, When Truth Is All You Have. There is no question about it, and I've heard this from most of our exonerees. When they're first consigned to the prisons, they have no support. Nobody believes in their innocence. They're all alone in the world, and they're buried in prison for life or maybe facing death. Over the years, they are able to sustain themselves and gather the strength because they know the truth, And the truth is, they don't believe the truth. They know that the truth is that they didn't do this crime. And that keeps them alive. It keeps their hope going. It enables them to endure the unendurable and to suffer with equanimity, really. Now, it's painful. Don't get me wrong. It's not easy. But the candle of hope flickers, but never extinguishes, because they're standing on the truth. The truth is their friend, their ally. It never goes away. It's consistent. It's always there to strengthen their heart. So that's one reason why they're able to. And most of the people we freed, by the way, we don't come into the case on the average until they've been down for 15, 20 years. But most of the people we free have been in prison for well over two decades. It's a testament to the human spirit that when they emerge from this insufferable multi-decade experience and suffering, that they come out. And they really do, most of them, not all of them, most of them. They've somehow shed their anger and hatred, which they held on to for a number of years, until they realized it was just a cancer eating at them, and they got to let that go. And
that's a wonderful point to end on, Jim, before Rabbi Brian comes back, because you and the few of the exonerees I got to meet and talk to, the many you talked to, they all said exactly that to me. And that was probably the most remarkable part of this experience for me, was to see that these people lived through the most unimaginable pain, most unimaginable injustice, and came out of it and were not angry. And they all said exactly what you just said, that the anger was a prison in itself, and letting go of that anger was part of how they became free.
That's not to say that once they're freed and the road to recovery and to reintegrate back into society is not easy at all. It's filled with a lot of psychological and material potholes, but they're able to do it with the right kind of support, which we also try and provide.
You've helped a lot of them. You had one of them come live with you when he got out of prison, didn't you?
Yeah, for a while he did. He lived with Kate, my partner, and then with me for a while, because he had nobody. He didn't have a friend in the world. Well, he had a friend, but he had no family, nowhere to go to. He was penniless. He was all alone in the world. And he had spent, at that time, 39 years in prison for something he didn't do.
Yeah, amazing.
Yeah.
Well, I think Brian is coming back in now. There he is.
Thank you, Phil. And thank you, Jim. What an amazing discussion. So many great questions. You know, Jim, as a rabbi, I would love to engage in a religious philosophical discussion with you who graduated from seminary. But Phil mentioned this idea about justice, because, again, the edict is tzedek, tzedek, tirdof, justice, justice you shall pursue. And the word justice is written twice, and that's because it means that we're supposed to pursue justice passionately. And you were certainly passionate and driven in your pursuit of justice. And it became clear throughout the book, you were married to this pursuit. And this was your life. So thank you for sharing that. If I might just ask a question relating to the Black Lives Matter movement, because I think that is such an important place to be for us as a society and a community, especially given this summer of unrest. But there was a moment where you, I guess it was your first day, you were at the Trenton State Prison,
right,
and you were walking through the hall and you were being yelled at by someone, yelling obscenities and all sorts of things. And your immediate gut, we would call it in Jewish, the Kishka reaction, was that this fellow was Black.
That's
where you went, only to learn that this guy, Butch Layton, was a white fella.
Well, yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, Brian, because it is so reflective of what, you know, it was my first day on the tier, on the cell block as a student chaplain. And when I got to Butch, now I'm dressed all in black with a white collar, I look just like an Irish priest. And when I arrived at his cell, he's inside, I'm outside, he just verbally assaulted me. He said, "I hate the Catholic Church." He said words I can't repeat. He said, "I don't want to ever see you on this tier again. Now get the blank out of here right now." Well, I was shaken by that. I mean, I'm looking at him and I'm stunned. mirrors are coming out of the other cells to see what the commotion is about. And the African-American chaplain who was orienting me and walking me and introducing me to the inmates, he said, "Jim, let's take a break and get off the tier." And that's when I said to Joe Ravenel, the black chaplain at Trenton State Prison, I said, "Joe, who was that black guy yelling at me like that?" He says, "Jim, what guy?" I said, "The guy was just," he says, "Jim, that's Butch Layton. He's white." Mm. So I had the wrong race, let alone the wrong face. That says two things. First of all, it demonstrates the unreliability of eyewitness testimony, number one. But just as importantly, and maybe more importantly, I had this racial prejudice within me that was full of assumptions and expectations and discrimination that I didn't know I had. And it all came tumbling out in that one encounter. Mm-hmm. And that suggests to me, I'm a typical middle-class white person who had very little, except for what I was telling Phil about in Times Square, very little interactions with African-American people. And I like to have thought that I did have racial prejudice, but I in fact did because of ignorance. And I think a lot of Americans are in that same boat. And if they don't have an encounter with blacks, which a lot of our white middle-class population do not have, then buried within them is this kind of prejudice, which they don't know exists and wouldn't know until an encounter of this nature occurs.
Right. Thank you for sharing that. And so very important right now. And it's about people being honest with themselves and asking themselves hard questions. So we have a number of questions that some of our viewers are asking. So I'll ask these questions. I'll throw them in your direction, Phil or Jim. First question is, was there any action taken against the prosecutorial misconduct? I mean, generally speaking, obviously there's misconduct throughout the book. So is there action taken?
That's a very good question. And the answer is, and this is one of the recommendations I posed at the end of the book, and that is a lack of accountability. No, prosecutors can be criminally charged for their misconduct at trial, whether it be suborning perjury or falsifying evidence or committing any other obstruction of justice kind of crime, but they are rarely, and I mean rarely, rarely held to account for their misbehavior, their criminal conduct during trial of this nature. Also, a prosecutor civilly cannot be sued, literally is immune from civil suits because of this kind of behavior if it's demonstrated that he committed this kind of behavior in a trial. So they're protected. They've protected themselves.
Mm. Wow. Interesting. I'm curious, both you, Phil and Jim, what did the process of writing the book look like? It was riveting to read because, you know, here you are, Jim, doing Lord's work. You are God's instrument. Yet you were dealing with your own demons and your own challenges, and you were at the lowest of depths. Yet you rose up in so many incredible ways. And so I appreciate the honesty and the way in which you revealed yourself. What was that like to be so open about history and your personal struggles?
I just knew I had to come out, so to speak. I had to be honest. I had to tell the real story. I mean, if I'm going to be critical of others, and I've been critical of those who participate in the criminal justice system who have a hand in creating these false convictions, I got to be honest about myself. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I was, and not only that, but I felt comfortable with Phil because Phil, I just knew Phil did not judge me at all. He just let me talk in a non-judgmental way. And it was therapeutic for me to get this stuff out about my prior behavior. I think it's important for people to know of the evolution and the transformation process that was taking place. It's kind of a St. Augustine kind of history there. Although I think I did things that St. Augustine never thought of. I wanted to let the readers know who the real Jim McCluskey was, the good, the bad, the ugly. And it was good. It was easy to do that working with a fellow like Phil.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's guests are Jim McCluskey and Philip Lehrman, co-authors of the book When Truth Is All You Have, a memoir of faith, justice, and freedom for the wrongly convicted. They're joined in conversation by Rabbi Brian Glessman. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
I have some other questions from some of our participants, viewers this evening. How can we grease the wheels of justice in instances like Mr. Spencer's? This is not the first time I have heard this difficulty of getting people physically out of jail after new evidence has been discovered. Is it judges or prosecutors? Is it the system itself?
It's all of the above. There are a lot of obstacles and barriers put in the place of innocent people who've been in prison for quite some time. When you develop, most states, not all, will bar the post-conviction, I'm talking about. When new evidence is developed, most states have laws which prohibit you from introducing that new evidence if it emerges after a certain period of time, like within 1 year of the denial of your direct appeal. If you don't come up with new evidence, you have a difficult time getting that new evidence back in court. You have judges, you have prosecutors who don't want to hear that their office made a mistake, even though they may have not been personally directly involved. So the instinct and the inclination in their DNA is to fight you tooth and nail. And we encounter that a lot of the times. Local county judges who have been on the bench for quite some time, they feel they have to protect the reputation of their county in terms of they don't want the public to think that they're convicting innocent people and putting them in prison. So there's a lot of visible and invisible forces, part of human nature. We don't like to admit we're wrong. And especially putting an innocent person on death row or in life for prison, there's a lot of barriers that are difficult but not impossible to overcome. Once we have begun work on a case, and we hit the field to investigate it, if we're going to succeed in freeing that person, it takes anywhere from 5 to 10 years to go out, develop the new evidence. Work with Paul Castellano, our attorney, or other attorneys in the local area, and go back to court. You might get denied at the lower level. Then you go to the appellate level. Then you go to the Supreme Court. Then you might have to go to the federal courts. It all depends case by case, but it's a never ending process. The wheels of justice do go so slowly, like the tortoise.
Amazing. You have amazing intuition. You know, I've had experience in chatting with prisoners before, and you know, a lot of times they're very charming, and I'm kind of gullible, and you know, they're always innocent when I speak to them. How were you? Where did that come from? How did you get to that place where you had such good instinct about the people that you were working with, these prisoners, those who are incarcerated?
Well, first of all, Brian, the vetting process is very thorough and very methodical. Once we get, this is on the average, of the 64 people we freed, as an example, on the average, it takes us anywhere from 3 to 5 years to vet their case. And that includes and involves, we get the entire written record of the case, The trial transcripts, legal briefs, police reports, you name it, we get it. We have an extensive communication correspondence with the inmate, asking that person a ton of questions. This takes time to develop the record and to read it and to vet the case. The last step is for somebody, some senior executive at Centurion, who's going to manage the case if we take it on, to go interview that petitioner. That's the last step. We're interested not only in his factual or her factual innocence, what kind of life did they lead before they were falsely convicted? What have they been doing with all the time they've had in prison for, you know, these 15, 20 years? What kind of people are they? Mm. We have denied prospective clients of ours who have petitioned us because we were very uncomfortable with the violence in their background, even though we believe they were innocent. So we didn't take their case on. So it's a combination of those things. And then along with that's an objective study and review of the case. And then the subjective evaluation of the person once we meet them. And when I was doing this up until 2015, the first thing I would do when I would review a file, when our staff and volunteers and staff had really advocated internally, this looks like a good case, Jim, I would get the correspondence file. Mm-hmm. I wanted to see, what did these folks have to say and all, how did they answer all the questions we posed to them over the years, which is a pretty thick file of correspondence. That was kind of an indicator, a bellwether to me as well.
But there were a couple of times in the book where you knew you were sitting with them and you had, before you even left, you knew that you were taking this case.
Yeah. Well, in those cases you're referring to, Joyce Ann Brown in Texas, for sure. The Savannah 3 guys in Savannah. It was, you didn't have to have any sixth sense to know these people had nothing to do with this crime. Right. I mean, it was so obvious. I couldn't believe that Joyce was arrested or that the Savannah 3, and I would hope people might want to get the book and read about these cases because they're unbelievable. Yeah. I stutter trying to even talk about those cases.
No, that's Savannah 3 story.
Yeah.
So disturbing.
Yeah.
Because that could be any of us. That could be our kids.
Exactly.
There's a question here, and you kind of just referred to it and answered it. Have you ever helped a woman seek freedom? And you just spoke a bit about the Joyce Brown case.
Yeah, and I want to thank you for that. And I want to bring up one other. We freed three women. One of them was a woman named Ellen Reasonover. Ellen Reasonover was 22 in St. Louis. She was convicted of a St. Louis murder, the shooting death of a gas station attendant late at night. She was 22 years old. She had a little girl, 2 years old. She lived with her mother, and she went out one night to do her laundry, but ran out of change, went up to the local gas station to try and get change, and saw an African-American inside look at her and then go out the side door, get his car, and drive away. She thought he was closing up for the night. She gets up the next morning and reads that the white gas station attendant had been found shot dead. She reports that to the police, what she saw that night. They arrest her. Don't ask me to explain it. They arrest her, put her in a little community jail. And they get a career criminal in that jail cell to give a false jailhouse confession. Then they indict her based on that jailhouse confession. They take her to the county jail and they get another career criminal woman to say she confessed the crime. That's the only evidence against her. So they framed her. She had no criminal history whatsoever. She had a brother who had been in trouble with the law. Now, they wanted to kill her, Brian. They tried the death. She was convicted, and now the jury has to decide whether or not to give her death or not. It was 11-1 for death. One juror held out not to kill her, and thank God, because we exonerated her 19 years later. And if that juror had voted for death, we never would have been able to take the case because she would have been executed.
Unbelievable.
These things happen, and they happen far more often than any of us could imagine.
Yeah, and you think about the people, obviously, they don't have the resources. You know, there was one particular case where there were resources available. There's a question here that's actually directed at me, and the question is, why don't we have more rabbis at prison chaplains, as prison chaplains? I would say it's just because of the population itself. Although there are Jewish prisoners, we don't represent an overwhelming amount of the prison population, but there are Jewish chaplains. I know several of them. There are specific agencies, Jewish agencies, that do minister to Jewish prisoners and supply them with kosher food and prayer books and all sorts of Jewish resources. So they're definitely available, and they're out there. But again, it just, the population doesn't warrant that many rabbis in the system.
I don't think we've had a Jewish petitioner inmate asking for our help. I just, you're right. I mean, you don't see too many Jewish folks in prison doing life or death for crimes of others.
Brian, if I could jump in with one last question, just before they, you know, when you were talking about, maybe realize something I wanted to mention to Jim earlier. You know, we talk about the horrors that you've experienced in the criminal justice system, the horrors that all these people live through. But in these hard times, in these really hard times, people are always looking for inspirational stories. And I think it's important for us to note for everybody how incredibly inspirational these moments are. I was lucky enough to be there with you the day that the Savannah 3 walked free, sitting with their mothers in the waiting room. I'm going to cry just talking about it. Sitting there watching the mothers rock, saying, please give me back my child, please. And watching those kids when they went in, 45, 50-year-old men when they walked out, after 23 years, 25
26,
years.
26.
Watching that moment was one of the greatest experiences I had with you, one of the greatest experiences I've had ever. As we wrap up tonight, in addition to talking about all the things that are wrong with the justice system, can you take us into that moment for you, what it's like for you after all of the work you do when you get to walk out with those prisoners into the light of day?
Well, Phil, thanks for bringing that up. I think that's a good way to possibly end this this hour conversation, because, when it takes us a long time, as I indicated earlier, to free those we serve. And in the process of doing that, we become not only their advocates, but we become their friends of not only them, but their families. We get close to the families. We communicate. We tell them what we're doing, how the case is going, what the prognosis is. And so there are bonds of rapport and trust that are established between us and the family members, and particularly the mothers. The mothers are the ones who stick by their sons or daughters. They never leave them. Sometimes you don't see the fathers too often, but you always see the mothers. And to bring that their child home after so long of imprisonment, and deliver them into the arms of their eagerly awaiting mother and brothers and sisters, it just doesn't get any better than that. That's why we do what we do. That makes it all worthwhile to deliver them, to redeem their lives. The family lives are broken too during this incarceration. And this starts to make everybody whole, although it takes some time once they get out. But it's a beautiful moment, and it's pure joy.
Beautiful. And Ellen asks, what is your relationship with the Innocence Project?
Well,
do you have a relationship with the Innocence Project?
Yes, we do. Paul Castellare, our lawyer, and Kate, they have been the ones who have really established close relationships with Barry Scheck and Peter Neufeld of New York, and other Innocence Projects across the country. We have worked with several of them, have joined us in working to free the particular Centurion Mysteries client. So yes, the answer is yes.
Nice.
This is a community effort. We're not in competition with other innocence projects. It doesn't work that way.
Right. And I so enjoyed, as Phil had mentioned, just the camaraderie that was developed that you continue to have with the exonerees and the get-togethers and the love. And not only that, but that so many of them have been inspired to then go on and do amazing, great things. And you used the analogy of a candle earlier, the idea that this, you know, the flame has infinite possibilities.
Yes.
And, you know, it never decreases in its energy, continues to light other candles, which light other candles, which light other candles, and ultimately brings so much brightness to the world. And in Hebrew, we use the word bracha, which means blessing, which actually also has the same root as the word pool, like a swimming pool in Hebrew.
Uh-huh.
Because a blessing is so much like a pool of water, the ripple effect. So how amazing this work is. And both you, Phil, and Jim, thank you so much for bringing this book to life and to light and bringing it to our attention. And, you know, I know that both of you will continue to do amazing things and be a blessing to this world. And lives are being saved because of you. So how amazing it is.
Let me add one more thing, Brian.
Yeah.
Not only are lives being saved, but lives are being created.
Ah.
Beautiful. In other words, when so many of I'm a lifetime bachelor, when a number of our exonerees are freed over time, they meet the woman of their life and they get married and they have children. Mm. And it goes on and on. So it's that is particularly gratifying to see that. And Kate, my partner of many, many years, and I, we become the godparents of several of their children.
I love that.
It's a beautiful thing.
I love that. Yeah, it is a must read. I couldn't put it down. Again, the way in which the personal stories were interwoven throughout, you know, I needed to get to the next chapter to see what was going to happen at Times Square, Jim. Thank you. Great. It's a great read. A special thanks to both of you, Phil and Jim. Thank you for sharing your stories, and please buy the book and learn more about those wrongly convicted and the continued pursuit of prison reform. Stay safe, my friends. Stay healthy.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you, Brian. And I really appreciate you taking the time to read the book and moderate this. I appreciate it very much. That. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guests were Jim McCloskey and Philip Lehrman, co-authors of the book When Truth Is All You Have, a memoir of faith, justice, and freedom for the wrongly convicted. They were joined in conversation by Rabbi Brian Glusman of the Marcus JCC in Atlanta. I'm David Kwan, editor and producer of the program, and Tina Pemenswan is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Roshanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. Thanks for listening.